That's a fucking apple tart right there. That's what that is. Hi, everybody. I'll explain that in a moment. Welcome to the Coogan Chronicles podcast, a podcast where two former child actors
interview other former child actors
about what it was like
growing up in the spotlight. I beat you.
In the spotlight. Yeah, you beat me. That is my, that's one of my Irish jokes. My wife's Irish and, I often impersonate.
It's not a joke. It's just making fun of Irish
people. Just making fun of Irish people. I don't do the best accent, despite having been with her for years and hearing one all the time. But that's it. But I just think every now and then I just look at a good Irish pastry and I think, that's a fucking apple tart right there. And I love saying it like that. And I'm going to get rid of the screaming okay as we start every episode, because one, it's not actually that funny. And two, someone AJ ran into in real life who listens to the podcast said kindly to AJ that she turns her volume down in her car every time she listens because she knows I'm just going to scream and blow out her eardrums. So out of respect for that person's delicate eardrums, I'm gonna get rid of that altogether. Yeah, it's done. We buried it. I know I've been saying it, but it's gone. AJ, let's get to some real stuff. Let's talk about some real stuff.
Yeah, Chris. So, Mara, episode two coming up.
Episode two.
What are we going to talk about before we get to that?
Okay. So, we're thinking about, like, you know, as we delve into things, we're thinking about all kinds of just general ideas that relate to former kid actors. And the first thing that came to my mind this week was, why is it so hard to quit? Why is it so hard for former kid actors to stop? Because quite often, 99% of them, I'd say, don't ever stop. They're still going. You know, they're still a part of the entertainment industry as actors in some form or another. Even ones that started even ones that are now in their 70s, you know, quite often they'll be like, I'm still an actor. You know, like I don't know if it's 99%, but it's definitely a majority of them, I feel like. Do you feel like that?
I don't know that. I would say it's probably at best 50-50.
It's not 50-50 split. Here, you know what? Here's better. I would argue, because this we would never know for sure, 99% of former kid actors, even if they're in their 70s, if you asked them seriously to go act again in something, they'd say yes. If it was a good thing, if it was a decent thing, if they're like, yo, look, we're doing this really cool reboot of some really dope show, and we want you to play this awesome role. You'll just come in for a few days and knock this out of the park, and it's a stellar cast and a great director. Absolutely, 100%. But they could be like, I haven't dusted off my acting chops in 45 years, and they will jump in.
Although I would argue that a majority of people, period, probably, if you said, hey, do you want to be in this really cool Marvel movie? All you have to do is stand there and say this one line and you just get to play yourself. A majority of people would say, yes, that sounds amazing. I would love to. I get to tell my grandparents to watch me for the next.
I don't know if a majority of people would do that. I don't know.
But back to the whole subject here, because it is true. It is hard to stop.
It's hard to leave. Do you know why I think it's hard to leave?
I really would like to know why you think that.
Because it's the most cush fucking job on the planet in many ways, until it totally isn't. But I just...
Well, so people that never really work in a meaningful way, that never are able to pay their bills as an actor, but they also can't stop. So they haven't tasted the cushness per se.
But I think even if that's the case, I think there's still a huge component there that you got to take into consideration, which is when you're acting as a kid, when you're a performer, there's a lot you do. Most of the time you're very dedicated. So even if you're not working and paying the bills, and even if you're not involved in some kind of project that you can hang your cap on, essentially, you will find a lot of places that are very validating. You'll find acting coaches, you'll find casting directors and agents, and you'll find a lot of people that will be very, very validating towards that endeavor. You will, because essentially you're a kid, and so people are very supportive of kids. And so when you're really trying to do this, I think one of the first and major things that makes it difficult for anyone to consider really leaving is if you have an inbuilt, ingrained experience of positive reinforced validation, you know, for your efforts, that's going to stay with you. And it's hard to give that up. I think it's hard to give up that part of you.
Chris, could it be as simple as you can't win the lottery if you don't buy a ticket.
And it could be that too. Yeah, that's totally.
You don't go on the audition. You don't stand a chance. But I'll tell you what's not hard to give up: going to acting class.
It's not hard to quit going yeah, to acting class. Definitely not. Yeah,
but it certainly is hard to quit the possibility that your entire life could change because you booked that one role.
That's true. But do you think that's it? Do you think that is the ultimate what majority of people would be hanging on to?
I think there's something that comes, this feeling of admitting defeat. So long as you continue to try, you don't have to admit defeat. And for any person, admitting defeat is really difficult, whether it be acting or something else. And I think maybe there's something to like going out on the limb and having a really grandiose dream and declaring to your family and friends, I'm going for it, right? Everyone else is comfortable staying at home or taking the easy road, but I'm going for it. I'm following my dream. And there's something like, I don't know if it's
that story thing. To me is like a, I don't know. It's like a story from the 1940s. That doesn't exist. No one did. I know you kind of did. You went to your parents who were like, I'm doing it. I'm going for my dream. You're like you're the rarity in that nobody does that. You're the only person who's like walked out of like a Tom and Huck Finn novel and said, just stated to all his friends and family, I'm going to endeavor into acting. And then tried to go do it.
I can specifically remember my last day at junior high school and telling all my friends that I was leaving to go to Los Angeles.
Go fuck yourself, Jake. Is that what you did?
Hey, my friend's name was Jake. Did you know that?
See, I did. I probably did in the back of my mind. No, here's what I think. I think a few things. I think that being on a set and going to work is one of the dopest experiences ever. I mean, when you show up to a good set True. Set with money, that's well run. You know, you got people that'll cook anything you want for you at any given time. You are surrounded by very happy, positive, smart, capable people. It's really exciting job in general. You don't know where you're going to be next. You don't know what's going to happen. You got to go with the flow of things. There's these 1,000 moving parts and you're watching it all come together, and then it all stops right when you start saying your lines, and it's just like it's a whirlwind experience. And I think that there's a million things about it that people would easily latch on to and love. So I think that's one thing.
Making television shows, period, is the greatest thing. It's the greatest job. Telling stories for a living and doing it in filmed entertainment is incredible.
Yeah. So like why? So there's that reason. But then there's another reason, which I think is this. I think that when you end up doing a part, you know, a role in particular as a kid, that later on in your life, and I know this for myself to be true, but I definitely sense it with a lot of other former kid actors, is that role does become a part of your identity at some point. It just does. The same way maybe if you were a kid who played soccer or football or a swimmer or a cheerleader and you won some big prize or you did that to an exceptional ability, that later on as an adult, that becomes a fabric of your identity. It just does as you look back on it. And so I think that part of the difficulty for former kid actors to ever consider or at some point make the decision to leave acting, to stop pursuing it, I think you have to wrestle with that. I think you have to wrestle with the roles that you did and the parts that you did and the time that you spent acting, that letting go of that part of your identity. And I think it's really, really challenging because you're a kid, because, you know, that is how often is somebody asked to let go of a part of their childhood in that respect, you know, in a way where it's like, that's just gone, you know? Maybe they are. Maybe people do that all the time. And I'm just being melodramatic.
Well, I think people do it all the time. But I think that it doesn't change the fact that the acting experience as a young person is more novel, and the desire to keep doing it into adulthood. I mean, you can't be a career little league player, you know? you can be a career actor. But
you can be a career actor. Yeah.
So it's novel in that respect. But anyway, why don't we just stop yapping here and get onto the episode?
Well, we're going to get back into our episode. And for anyone who hasn't read Mara Wilson's book, Where Am I Now? You should. And she actually does have a chapter in her own way that does deal with this idea that a role you play as a kid can become part of your identity as an adult. And she has this beautiful chapter, actually, where she writes about saying goodbye to Matilda, to the role of Matilda. as an adult, that she just needed to sort of come to peace with saying goodbye to that character and that not being her identity. And it's really beautifully written. It's poetic, it's smart, and it's great. And it's worth, if you have any interest in the subject of kid actors, it's really worth checking out. And so, yeah, man, without further ado, part two of our chat with Mara Wilson.
But like, I knew you and I liked you a lot. Like, I remember us going on that audition for The Safety of Objects, which I talk about in my book.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Do you remember
that? I did. Oh, yeah.
And I remember being like, because there's like weird, there's stuff in there that I'm like, I don't know. And there's like kids experimenting with like heavy petting and stuff like that in an older parlance and stuff. And I remember actually my dad talking to your mom about it. And
really?
Your mom being like, yeah. And your mom being like, well, Chris has told me that they can have like props and stuff, so nobody's actually touching anything. And and like, we talked about that. We talked about body doubles and stuff. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I don't know how comfortable I would feel doing these scenes, but at least I know that Chris is nice and would be respectful. Like, and I did not think I was going to get that part. And I didn't.
Me either.
But I remember thinking, like, I could kind of tell that you were kind of like, don't really know what I'm doing here. But
yeah. Anything before the age of like 20 years old that had anything to do with sexuality, I was so far from that in my own life.
Yeah.
That, like, it was just like this overbearing. And
totally.
That's, I think I used to make that up every time just to go on the audition, is I would say, they'll get a body double.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
you're asking me to do this.
I remember being so excited when I got an audition for a pregnant teenager, and because I was like, that, wow, they think that I could play a character who's had sex, because I did not have sex in high school. I was
mine was much later.
Yeah, mine was much later.
I just remember
too.
Yeah, I was like, I'm gonna be the last person I know to ever be naked in front of anybody.
Yeah.
Like that for sure.
Pretty
by
much
years.
The same.
Yeah, by
pretty
years.
Much the same. And and yeah, it was then, and I had a serious boyfriend in college, and that was a thing too. But like, I think about that a lot. And I know like Evan Rachel Wood has said she felt like she didn't really understand her sexual orientation much later because there was so much pressure on her and there was so much looking at her. And I feel like that was definitely me too. Like, I came out as bi much later. And I think that that was also because dating at that age, I mean, it's gross. It feels like mating in captivity. You know, the first person I seriously dated had never seen Matilda. Yeah. A lot of the people that I've dated in the past few years have been like super nerdy. Like, if you look at my dating history, it's like mathematician, engineer, astrophysicist.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of makes sense.
You need a good brain. Yeah, you're incredibly bright. Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't know if someone's like, well, I was a former child actor too.
You'd be like, I mean, there's been times. There have been times, you know, where that's kind of, you know. But usually I'm like, no, I need somebody who wasn't as clued into this.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
As a kid who was off studying the periodic table or something.
And who did it just sort of, you mind me asking, when you have your first boyfriend in college, did the fact that you say like, and he had never seen Matilda.
Yeah.
Is that what, like, did you ask him one day, like, have you seen Matilda? And he says no. And you go, great, we're dating. Or does it just, is it just a bonus that you just happen to, you like, you just, it's a normal young love. And then all of a sudden one day you're like, have you seen Matilda? And he's like, no. You're like, oh my God, this is so great. Like, what?
I think it probably came up pretty early because this was very early in my college experience. And he was a genuinely sweet guy. Like, I'm like, it's a good thing we're not together now. I think that it's better for us to have lived our own lives, but like, he was a genuinely good guy. And I'm lucky that he was my first love. But I remember it must have come up early on. And the thing was that, but the thing that I liked about him was that he knew a friend of mine from school. He'd gone to summer camp with her. So he was like, I was like, oh, you know, Miss Strahl, that's so cool. Let's talk about her. And she's great. And so we talked about that and kind of bonded over that. And we bonded over some like really, really nerdy things, like a cappella groups and like really nerdy things. And he loved film. And I was like, well, you know, I know a little bit about film. because I was in it. And we would talk about my experiences there. And then I think he was like, yeah, you know, I never saw Matilda. And I was like, that's great. That's perfect. And it's funny.
Was there a sense of relief? Like, did you have a nagging thing in your head ever? Like, he likes me because of Matilda. Like, that's a part of this equation.
I've had people say, like, I loved Matilda. Can we date? You know, I thought you were so cute in that movie. And I'm like, that doesn't make me want to date you. And like,
that's not a good pickup line. Yeah.
And a lot of, yeah. And definitely some guys have used that. And a lot of women have too. And I'm just like, that's not, you know,
fucked up and weird and not okay.
It's super weird. It
brings to mind the scene in Bad Santa where like he's like drunk and some woman's like, let's go to the car, and she's like, fuck me Santa.
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
Something like, really disgusting.
It's like,
and
it's like really weird. Like,
yeah, somebody's acting out some really horrible thing. They need a lot of therapy.
Exactly. So I've had to be very careful with that because that's just like such a strange. That's such a strange thing to me. And I don't understand that. Like the motto should be DFYF. Starts with don't and ends with your fans. You know? It's a power imbalance, and it's not fair. It's not fair to the fans, and it's not fair to the person up on, like, it's hard to be on a pedestal, you know, by people you don't know. It's really hard. And so it's not fair to them.
Well, that's an interesting, I just want to ask you like to almost segue into your book just for a bit. Because that's one of the, I think one of the most interesting things you explore in your book with that letter that you write to Matilda with the, you know, I don't know if people realize there's this, I think one of the biggest things I wanted to talk to you about in this podcast was that, you know, when there's this, there can be this thing for any actor of any age where your life can bleed into a character and the character's journey that you embody in your work. And it can almost become a part of your, I think, a part of your fabric in your actual life, like almost like a memory of like, oh yeah, that was that time. Like maybe for other people who are not actors, there's a time where they won a tournament of some kind, or they wrote some really cool thing that the school paper ran and everybody got, you know, maybe there's like something, right, that you look back on with a nostalgia, or that becomes a part of your identity as you move forward.
Yeah. Well, it's like people who were popular in high school.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
You know, and that can be it, where you can still later on say, well, at least I was the captain of the football team. You know,
there's
something to that. Like when I read your book, I was thinking when you wrote this letter to the character Matilda, I was thinking about how, because in it, you know, you talked about when they revamped the idea of Matilda and brought it to stage and made it a musical, that your initial reaction to it was almost like a pang of like a fear and a sadness maybe. And it kind of was like, wait, what, without me? Like, what is this? And it made me think of like, I remember a few years ago, I read an article with Robert Downey Jr. and he was talking about Iron Man and playing Tony Stark. And he was saying, I could play this role every day for the rest of my life. This is it. This is my opus. This is the thing that defines me as an actor, is what it felt like he was saying.
He's great in that role.
And he is. You know? I think that is why people love that role, because it's almost as much Robert Downey Jr. as it is the character of Tony Stark.
Yeah.
But my thing when I thought about it is I was like, yeah, well, what happens 10 years down the line when they say, hey, Robert, sorry, man, we're going to restart the franchise and we're going to put everybody at college age, and there's going to be a 24-year-old Tony Stark and we're never going to use you again. Yeah. What happens? You know, what does does Robert Downey Jr. have a total breakdown? Is it like, how does that feel? And I feel like that equates to what people don't realize is like, you know, there are these roles you can play as a kid and these particular journeys in these projects that can later become, you know, a part of the fabric of who we are as people.
There's a great quote that I think about all the time. Carrie Fisher is one of my heroes. I love her so much. And I met her briefly at a premiere when I was maybe 9 or 10. And I was just in awe because I was a little Star Wars nerd kid. And like her one woman show and her book, like her books are like some of my favorite books. And I think it's also because like, oh my God, I want to see that movie so badly. I can't seem, it's not streaming anywhere. It's pissing me off. But like Wishful Drinking is my favorite. And and I think also because like, I don't come from a Hollywood family, but I come from a family where there's like a lot of bipolar disorder and a lot of like, you know, upheaval and a lot of things like that. Like that's like what my ancestors are. And so I think there's partly I can relate to her because of that, because that mental health, mental illness thing is very familiar to me, but also because she played this character that like so many little girls loved and so many boys had crushes on it. Like just so many people loved this character and know this character. And she had this wonderful quote where she said, I feel like Princess Leia and I have merged in the past few years over my life. And I'm kind of glad of that. Like we've merged in a way. And I think that that's fine. And I was like, oh my God, I know exactly what she means, because I still feel like Matilda's influence on my life every day, because Matilda is somebody who's strong and she speaks for justice and she's intelligent. And like for a long time, I resented it, for probably even like until well into my 20s. I was so bitter and I was so resentful of having this character hang over my head all the time. But now I'm like, you know what? Matilda was a person. She was a character that I wanted to be like when I was 5, when I was 6. And now I'm in my 30s and I still want to be like her. I still want to read all the time. I still want to, you know, stand up for people who are suffering from injustice. I still want to do these things. And so in some ways we have kind of merged. I feel like I have sort of taken on, you know, and I'm not as smart or well-read or as powerful and strong as she is, obviously. I don't have magic powers, but I feel like I do try to take the best parts of her now. Yeah. But like, yeah, I think about that all the time, especially with like Marvel actors and stuff like that. Like you see it with people like Chris Evans, I feel like probably has like a huge weight on his shoulder to be like Captain America all the time. Yeah. Or, you know, and Chadwick Boseman definitely did too. Like, you know, yeah. may rest in peace. Just, you know, he had to be this, you know, and you'll hear stories where people will be like, yeah, they were a lot like their characters, but also I think you kind of have to be.
Yeah, I think you kind of have to be to embody them, you know, for the most part. And, you know, but there is a strange, I think there's a facet of acting that not everybody is either aware of or wants to take into consideration. Yeah. Where, you know, where people don't realize, you know, because I think that's what I liked so much about your writing when you talked about Matilda and talked about the roles you played as a kid and how you understood how you had affected other people's lives and how they saw yeah. you. And that's a strange thing to grow up and measure up against in your life.
Yeah.
You know, I think like maybe the way I'd equate it is like, you know, it's that if you're the captain of the football team, everybody else might look at you the rest of your life thinking, well, aren't you big and brave? And don't like, what are you scared yeah. of? You're the captain of the football team, bro. Like just get yeah. out there and, you know, make it happen. You know, it's like, maybe that's how you live with this impression that, you know, you're expected to be a certain way. And really at the end of the day, you're like, well, I'm a human being and I'm going to go through what human beings go through. And I'm not always going to, and I shouldn't be expected to measure up against these weird ideals, you know?
Yeah, and I do think, I don't know if we have yet touched on the weird interconnectedness of child stars and child act. I don't know. I'm like, every now and then I'm like, should I call myself a child star? I was a child yeah. actor. Who defines what a star is?
We've
struggled with that too.
We use like yeah, young right? performer, child actor, kid actor, right. child star. Yeah.
We've gotten way too comfortable at saying it now that we're yeah. former kid actors. Cause I even yeah. the first time we had to, like when someone said, hey, can you just write up a little thing about it? Mm-hmm. Cause we're making a website and they're like, can you just write up a little blurb? And we sort of were like, yeah, two former kid actors interview other former. And we were like, ew, dude, no. Like,
yeah, it's a no. weird label to self-describe.
Yeah, I was like, I've never, yeah. and you said it best. You said this thing here. I just want to, you said, You wrote something about, you said you're much more reformed drama nerd than yeah, former child star.
I really you know? Am. Like I'm just a nice. Musical theater. I'm a corny bitch who loves musicals, you know. That's that's who I am. Like that's really, I am a drama nerd. I really am. And I still love spectacle and I still think that that's something that's, you know, a big part of me. And I think that's probably why when I was kind of getting tired of film and moving away from it, and I was in this awkward age where I wasn't, you know, I would self-sabotage on auditions, and a lot of it has to do with like me being uncomfortable with the way that I looked. And so much of that, I think that's when I really started to turn to doing drama and doing choir and really performing on stage. And that felt more real. And also I think that I was kind of a control freak, but in theater, you have control over your performance. You know, it's just you up on stage. And I hated having to answer to directors and editors. And I thought that that was so boring and so not fun. And now I think as I've gotten older, I've gotten much more nostalgic about being on film sets and I've wanted to be there in a different capacity. And like one thing that I think about on film sets all the time is, and one thing that I miss is what I call the rolling chorus, which is what everybody, the whole thing that happens when somebody yells, okay, rolling. They go rolling and there's this like call and response with all the 80s yeah. going rolling,
then, we're rolling, yeah. rolling
yeah.
on set. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Like and you know,
circles inside a pond and they just keep rippling further and yes. further out, further and further away.
And you know, speed marker, you know, sound speed marker, and background action. Like, yeah, that kind of thing. It feels very comforting.
That's strange. You know what? One of those comforting moments of my life is after we've shot something and they need to get wild sound, room tone. Mm-hmm. And so there's just this minute where the entire set has to sit there and everybody has to be quiet.
Yes.
And it's just a full minute where everybody's just stuck there for a second. And most people seem really annoyed and very hungry and they just want to keep going. But I just, for me, I'm like, that's like the nicest. I'm like, yeah, I could die there.
Yeah,
like, I'm like that. I love that part.
It's also my favorite part of Shabbat dinner.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that is nice.
It's funny how many child actors are Jewish, and a lot of us are Jewish or Italian, aren't we?
AJ and I are Jewish, but
I'm
been
Italian.
Having a Shabbat dinner. You are Italian. That's true.
Yeah. There's definitely. I think like most white kid actors I knew were Jewish or Italian. I think there's.
It's because our families are loud. It's because our families are loud. Everyone's talking. Talking over each other, and that's just part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I squeaked in. I'm a Cuban family.
Your family's the loudest family I know.
I mean,
we're louder than all you guys combined.
That's Latino families too.
Okay, so there's so much in the book, but we have actually weirdly touched on so much of it, you know, as we've been having these conversations. But you said something in particular. You said this little thing, and I was gonna point out big chapters, and I thought there's these little things to me to stand out in your writing. Like you said something, you're on the set of Mrs. Doubtfire, I believe, and you said something like, "Oh, I couldn't wait to work a 9-hour day."
Yeah.
And it was like, and I was like, oh, I remember that, where I thought, like, that's a weird aspiration you have. You're like, yeah, I'm going to turn 12 and then I get to work 9 hours, not 8.5 or 8 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it just made me think, right, of like, thank God the rules are in place as they are. Because I think with young kid actors that really enjoy what they're doing, they'd be like, hey, are you okay with a 26-hour day? And they'd be like, oh, fuck yeah. You know, like it'd be so easy. And I thought of this time. This is all a disclaimer to my question to you. I thought of this time where I had done a Burger King commercial. We were done. I was already over. It was already overtime. I had school the next day. I had an important something going on at school the next day. And they said, hey, you know, I'm the face in the commercial. And they said, but we need the part of the commercial where it's just a hand that is playing with the toy. Would your kid be interested in doing this? We'll throw you guys like another $100, but it's going to be a while. We got to reset the whole set and do all this, relight everything. And, you know, my mom said yes. And I remember it was like midnight at this point. We're in New York. I got to go back to Jersey. I got to go all the way there. I got to get some sleep and go to school the next morning. And we did it. And I just remember years later, I was like, that shit's not cool. You can't even ask. You shouldn't even be allowed to ask that. And they're not. They're not legally allowed to ask.
No, they're not.
At all. But I'm wondering, with you having been on so many sets and so many big complicated sets, because that's just a little Burger King commercial.
Yeah.
But on complicated sets, did you ever experience that? Were there times where you did end up working way over, even if you wanted to? Yeah.
Yeah, I did. And the things that seem messed up about it now is that they came to me directly to ask me, are you okay with doing it?
Yeah.
And that bothers me, because I was like, you didn't ask my guardians. You would come to me directly and play to me, and you should have asked them, and they should have been the ones to say no. But I mean, I did, and I didn't see it like as a big deal at the time, because I knew so many other child actors who had done it. But there were also times, I mean, on Matilda, like, you know, Danny would be like, oh, can we do more with her? And they'd be like, well, no, we can't. He'd be like, well, that sucks, but, you know, you have to move on. Although I do remember actually coming in on a Saturday to film a Matilda once. And that felt really weird to me, because I was pretty observant Jewish. So I was like, this is Shabbos. I shouldn't be working on Shabbos. This is the one day I shouldn't be working.
Yeah.
But then, like, I was like, well, I've watched TV on Shabbos before. So, you know, what I wasn't supposed to. So I think I'm fine. And and there was a lot of it. I mean, mostly, like, we worked during the summers, mostly because you can work longer hours. You don't have to be in school. So I worked on my birthday, I think, maybe 3 years in a row, something like that, 2 or 3 years in a row. I worked on my birthday. And probably the hardest thing, and this was actually one of the most difficult things, and this is another case in which I think that, you know, my bad experiences were not with Hollywood so much as they were with press. So I had to do a junket in Toronto on my birthday, on my 13th birthday. And that's not how you want to spend your 13th birthday. And I was hoping that I would go there and I would have like a day off in Toronto and I would be able to see my friends. And then the next day would be a junket. But they were like, nope, everything's on the 24th. We have to do everything on the 24th. And the first morning interview I did was with like one of their biggest newspapers. And I remember not being in the best mood, being kind of grumpy there. And you know, and saying they're like, oh, it's my birthday. I'm 2,000 miles away from home, you know. And the article that was written about me was fucking terrible. It was so mean. And it was just like, the interview hasn't even started yet. And Mara Wilson is complaining to her staff. And I hadn't actually, what had happened was that they'd come in and they'd be like, they were like, Mara, do you need any water or anything? We have some Cokes that are like freezing cold in the mini fridge. And I was like, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. And I joked, I was like, I think I need caffeine, but I'm fine. And she was like, you know, she's complaining to her staff. And I'm like, no, they asked me if I wanted anything to drink. And I joked about needing caffeine and you took that seriously. Yeah. And it's, you know, it says that she apologizes for sounding like a spoiled brat, but basically implying that she sounds like a spoiled brat. And part of that, I was like, do Canadians just not like American actors? Do they think that they're this and that, you know, was it like, but I was horrified about this because any 13-year-old is going to be unhappy on her birthday. And it's funny because I also did another interview that same day, like a few hours later with another Toronto newspaper, and they were so nice to me. And they were like, look at how happy she is on her birthday. And she's so sweet. And she's so this. And it's so like that article was one of the worst articles ever written about me. And I think about that now. And I'm just like, who do you have to be to write a shitty article about, you know, a 12, 13-year-old girl?
Exactly. Yeah. Who are you?
Who's doing there? This? What was your 13th birthday like? You know, exactly. And who do you have to be? And I think about that all the time. And just how awful it was. And it made me sound like a spoiled brat. But I think that's also the thing is, you know, you go expecting a spoiled brat and you know, you'll
find one.
Yeah. You're going to impose your own narrative onto it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think so too. I mean, the sad reality of someone, imprinting their own perspective onto a kid is ridiculous, especially I'm sure because there's so much that's forgiven. That's really obvious with adults. That should be a problem. You know, it's like, for them to like find that thing, you're like, dude, if you really want to find an ego, you just have to spit in a direction and you'll hit somebody and you're going to rag on a 13-year-old. I did want to ask about, because there's not many former kid actors, I think, that have chaperones and nannies always on set. And I did. And I loved that little, you know, it brought to mind that, the nanny on set that's really just got a headshot and looking to maybe break into the biz.
Yes, I had that. Yeah.
But for anyone listening who has no idea, right, of this possibility in a kid actor's life, can you walk us through a little bit of like how you found these nannies or on set people and what that was like and why there were different ones? And
well, I mean, a lot of this was because my mother had died, or my mother was very sick, and she wanted to be there the whole time. She really wanted to be there, but she couldn't be when she was, you know, going through cancer treatment. And she had said like before she died that she wanted to have, you know, particular people there. Sometimes they were like one, I think we met because she was like a second cousin twice removed or something like that, you know, like through marriage. But she had come to LA wanting to act. And so she worked with us, but she was like going on auditions and like doing game shows, which is like what all adult actors do when they first move to LA. They'd go on game shows. Like you see videos
dating
of like
and reality shows.
Dating shows you see the factor. Like I was gonna say, like, you see people like Aaron Paul and John Hamm on like old, you know, things like The Price is Right or Dating Game. And she did that, and I do remember she worked on a movie I did and very specifically asked if she could have a line so she could get her SAG card. Which at the time, like, I loved her, so I was cool with it. But now I'm like, that's kind of messed up.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot to ask of the producers. Yeah.
Other ones we had were people that we worked with. And my mom was like, well, you seem to get along well and you seem organized. Do you want to work with us? And then there were others who, like my Lucy, who was with me on Thomas and the Magic Railroad, she came from the studio. They were like, this girl is really bored and her dad can't be there all the time because they have a big family. do you think you could like accompany her? And she was like, yeah, okay. So she came there and then we got along well enough.
And that you were filming, because I read about that. That's what brought this to mind is Lucy, the caretaker. And you said she was wonderful. And you said you guys were filming in London, which is obviously far from Los Angeles.
We weren't in London. First, we were in the Isle of Man, which is an island.
Oh, the Isle of Man.
Yeah. She was from London, or she lived in London. So she came over from London. Yeah.
And so my wonder is, like, since you're living somewhere you don't actually live, do you guys share a hotel room? Does she pick you up every, does she knock on your hotel door and say, it's 5:30 a.m. you got a 6 a.m. call, let's go?
In the Isle of Man, my dad was there. And my brothers, my family were there because we were like a lower middle class family with a lot of kids. And really the only chance we ever had to have vacations was via, you know, these things, via like different opportunities we had. And I remember my dad making an agreement that we would all fly coach to London from LA, which is not very comfortable, but, you know, he's like, can we fly coach London from LA to London so our family can stay there? And they were like, yeah, sure, that's fine with us.
And the trade-off is, right, they're like, look, we could either fly Mara on a private jet.
Exactly.
And she'd have a foot masseuse there the whole time. Or can we trade all those perks in for five
Say in this. Hold on.
Because I remember Cody, one of the other actors there, he was flying in business class. And I was like, how come he flies in business class? And he's like, well, because he doesn't have a bunch of siblings that are basically using this as a vacation, you know.
I totally relate to the vacation thing. I didn't go anywhere with my family ever except my grandma's house, except when I traveled for work. And that,
me too.
We were like a camping family. We'd go out into the mountains and like maybe stay at a motel. But but usually that was the kind of people that we were. But yeah, but then Lucy came with me, and a few months later we went to Toronto. I remember like my college boyfriend studied abroad and came back like very different after having studied abroad. And I was just kind of like, he came back from studying abroad and we broke up, which is like the classic story. Like that also happened to my brother. And that also happened to like all my friends. Like your girlfriend, boyfriend goes to study abroad and they come back and they're different. That always happens.
Well, they're like an alcoholic and they're smoking cigarettes all the time. They just got back from Europe.
Like he started telling me about the London drinking culture. And I was like, come on, dude.
You're 16.
You're 21. You can barely drink. Like, yeah, there was a lot of that. But I remember him being like his life was so different since he'd lived in another country. And I thought to myself, okay, but when I was 12, I was living in another country without any of my family, you know? So I was 12 and I went to Toronto and they got this like beautiful like townhouse for us. And so like Lucy had her room and I had mine. And it was like one of the most beautiful houses I've ever stayed in. And she had her room and I had mine. And, you know, I'm hard to wake up in the morning, but she would come up and she'd be very perky and go, Miss Mara, you know, time to get up. And we would get in the car and I'd be really grumpy and, you know, they'd give me like a bagel or something. And she'd say to our driver afterwards, thank you very kindly, Dushin. And she was really perky and really fun. And like we would get home and we would watch like ER together and stuff like that. And I remember once like she made me food and I didn't like it. And I was like, can I have ice cream? She's like, you're not having ice cream after, you know, you just threw away the food I gave you. And so there was very much like parental, even though she was probably only in her late 20s at the time. But yeah, she was, you know, and having like the British kind of au pair seems like a stereotype, but she was great. Lucy was really, really helpful. And I look back on that now and I'm like I nannied when I was in my 20s, but I can't imagine like living in another country with a child.
Yeah, you know, and a kid who's got to show up every day to work.
Exactly,
It's one thing to help a kid with their homework. It's another thing where you're like, do you need me to read lines with you? Are you okay? Do you need a bathroom break? We got to get you to school. Like it's
having
a
to advocate for them. Yeah. Like she and Lori, like Lucy and Lori were like, they were like this wonderful tag team of like people who were always in my corner. And that was really great. And that was, I had that a lot on other sets too. It'd be like Jenny and Richard are always going to be there to stick up for me, you know, or whoever was there with me at the time. But yeah, I think about that now. I think about like the many nannies who would like fly with me to New York and didn't get enough sleep because they were dragging me around. And I feel for them because I'm like, they were younger probably than I am now. And I can't imagine having done that.
When I was a teenager, I had to go to New York to do Say What Karaoke, I think. I was like 16 and I needed a chaperone. I needed a chaperone. And so the drummer in my band ended up being the chaperone, but he just got blackout drunk on the airplane. I don't think I saw him for the entire weekend.
Yeah. I mean, I was.
Irresponsible nannies, or they all seemed cool?
Some were definitely irresponsible. Like we had some who would like just take off and go drinking and were, you know, were very irresponsible. Or they would like take things from our house or like stuff like that. And it was like, what are you doing? Like I definitely had some like negative experiences with them, or they just wouldn't get it. They would just be like, why do I have to drive you here? And it's like, well, it's for an audition. And they'd be like, but why? You know? And so there definitely were some, I don't remember that many that were like, just like totally irresponsible. Like, I think my parents were very clear about that. But I also feel like, I don't know, I also feel like the kind of quality of movies that I was in fell off after a while because I just kind of wanted to keep working. And there aren't that many good parts for kids, you know, 11 to 12. And, you know, if you want to keep acting, you're going to have to be in some movies. I would always say they can't all be To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, they can't all have these amazing parts for kids. But
yeah, I think there's an insane amount of luck with kid actors as they continue acting. And I've always said, too, I really think that depending on the content you work in, you know, it's a... Like a lot of former kid actors, young kid actors who do adult content, movies in particular, you know, they find a much easier transition as they
do
continue forward because they got all these adults that have seen them in a more adult light, and it's just an easier jump, you know?
It definitely is. But I also think there's a lot of pressure to be sexualized there, especially for young girls, I think. And like, and although for many young boys too, like I can't even tell you how many teenage boys I knew who were dating like adult women, you know, and being preyed upon them, you know, and that's something that still, it bothers me so much just to think about. It's sort of a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing. And I think the people aren't very sensitive to it. And it still makes me a little uncomfortable sometimes to see these things.
You know, I was just wondering about that is like, were there instances in particular for you where you felt like at least someone was asking you to exploit yourself sexually as a young woman, or that there was like a, you were being asked to do something that was uncomfortable?
I don't feel like I had that so much. I definitely got scripts where I looked at it and was like, yeah, I wouldn't be comfortable with this. Like 13 I got, and The Safety of Objects I got, and you know, some things like that I got, and I was like, oh, I don't know if I could do this. Yeah. So that was something. I do feel I did have a lot of like grown men writing letters to me asking for like my lip print on an index card and telling me they liked my legs and, you know, things like that. Like I had a lot of sexual harassment outside of, you know, the actual industry. And that's something that I'm always talking about because people will be like, Hollywood is so rife with sexual harassment. And I'm like, yes, it is. But also it was the public. It was the world, public that was doing the harassing to me. So yeah, but I think that I was lucky. And for a while I was like, well, maybe it's just because I wasn't as cute of a teenager. I wasn't very pretty, you know, which is this incredibly stupid, messed up thing to think. But it is, and that's not it at all. It's you know, it's because I was more protected, I think. And I'm glad that I was, you know, my parents were also more conservative anyway. So that was probably going to be, you know, what they would have done anyway.
No, mine too. I mean, I remember I was supposed to try out for and meet the director of Happiness, Todd Solondz.
Oh yeah, Todd Solondz.
For that little boy whose father is a pedophile. And my mom read this script that ends with the little boy putting peanut butter on his nuts and a dog licking it off. Mm-hmm. And she was like, what the fuck is everybody?
Yeah.
I think she fired an agent. She's like, are you kidding? There was no world in which this was okay. And I think it is totally up to parents, you know, obviously to contend with those things. So you seemed though, like you had this, at least when I read in your book, it seems like when you started to go through that, when you started to become an adult and you're looking at your career as an actor, there's two questions I have for you. And the first is, I think a lot of focus for former kid actors can become the accolades, the respect, the results of these things. You seemed like you started to really gear your mind, like you were really vested young in the characters, in the acting, in the performance, in the actual like art of it all. And it seemed like you kind of moved there. You seemed to say to yourself, well, if I can do this, great. If I can't, then I'm not interested, or change your perspective on your acting career.
Yeah.
Was that always the case? Did you feel like, you know, was there ever a time where you felt like you wanted to start acting because you wanted to see a success, or you wanted to go to red carpet, or you wanted to, like, you know, what did that affect you, you think, young? Or
not really. Or I really don't think that was ever a thing for me. I think that the glitz and glamour was something that I never connected with it. And also the idea of accolades and such, I think that's really hard for kids to get, because there literally is so much time that passes between working on sets and working and the movie coming out and you hearing about all this, that there was a massive disconnect for me. And that's why when I started acting on stage and doing improv and doing choir and all of these things, that was so different for me. That felt so real, because it was this instant rush. You got the dopamine right away, just instant payoff, you know, getting a laugh. Like I remembered, like when I was like 11 or so, realizing that I could make people around me laugh, and that being incredible to me, being like, oh, am I funny? This is incredible. And it felt so different. I mean, it felt but I liked being part of a team too. And I think that that's really what being on a film set feels like. It feels like being part of a team. And that part of it, I miss, because I was the first daughter in a house full of boys. I always wanted to be included. You know, I looked up to my big brother so much. And you know, I had a younger sister who was like beautiful and adorable. And I loved being part of the team. So that was really what being on a film set was to me. And then when I got to be a teenager, I wanted more exploration of like my feelings on my own. And that's when I wanted to do more theater work and get that sort of instantaneous thing. And that's why I still love performing in front of audiences, because you get that connection there and you don't get that as much on film sets. And I think for a while I was kind of frustrated with film sets, and I thought the film acting wasn't fun, and it was, you know, I got very pretentious and was like theater is a more superior form to art, you know, when I was like 17. And then of course I kind of rediscovered, I was like, no, I do love film. And I also, you know, and I don't think it was until well into my 20s where I was like, you know, where I think like I was on Broad City, and just being on that set was so much fun because everybody on it was so funny. I thought to myself, oh, I do like this. I like being a part of something. I like just being in the room. I like being a part of it. And that, I think, is, and it reminded me what I had liked about it all along, what I had liked about it as a 5-year-old.
That's amazing. Because, you know, your story really, you know, you seem to transition really easily. It, like, you followed your passion for performing in front of live audiences. You followed your passion for writing. You seem to follow, and your passion to continue learning. You learned about plays. You learned about cinema. You learned, it's like, you know, a lot of people just stop. Like, well, just give me my sides and I'll just show up and I'll do the part. You know, you like really thrived, and it seemed like you then, it's not like you just, you didn't, it doesn't seem like you found yourself in an audition waiting room at 22 years old being like, the fuck am I doing? Like you had found so much about being an actor and a writer that meant a lot to you, and you kept moving. And so I think for me, it begs the question in my mind of like, you know, so you go onto a set years later, you have a lot of fun, or it reminds you of what you loved about it. So where do you stand now in your heart as being an actor? Like, do you think you'd ever throw yourself fully into the game again? And like, or actually, before that question too, was there ever a time where you stopped fully? Like you made a call to an agent and said, don't send me out for anything anymore. I'm done. Like, was there ever did you ever shift like that completely?
I do think that, yeah, there was a time, and I would say that was probably when I went away to boarding school, and probably when I went away to college too, because there were times that I got scripts. Like I did get the script for Joan of Arcadia.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I did. And I remember thinking later, like, oh, that probably would have been really fun. Because, you know, I had all these friends working on it, and that would have been, that would have been really fun. But and I remember being like, oh, this is a good script, but I don't think I can audition for it. Arrested Development was another one that I could have auditioned for. And I would have been there on that with my friend Mae Whitman, who I love. But I mean, first of all, I don't know that I would have gotten the part anyway. I don't know if I was right for either of those. And I think the actors that they chose for those were perfect. But I do think that there was kind of that. But I do think that I got much more into, you know, I did kind of stop acting. People be like, oh, she stopped acting. And I'm like, well, I never stopped doing voiceover. Mm-hmm. I mean, but it was good. My parents were like, you should take time off. You should explore what you love. And then I was very unhappy in the public high school. My dad was like, you know, you're really only happy when you're performing. Why don't you go to a performing arts school? And then when I was there, I sort of discovered that I loved being behind the scenes in theater. And then when I was in college, I discovered, oh, actually, I really love film too.
And so
I think that being a part of something is something that, and that's something that I've loved about theater, is that it's inherently collaborative, but I think that film can be too. You know, film, I think we tend to think of like directors with big egos and studios and such, but there is a way, I think, to be in film to do this. And so, and I think that's also why Stardom doesn't particularly appeal to me, because I like being a part of something, you know? And I do think that I have a loud voice. I have a big personality. I'm probably going to stand out in certain places, but the aspects of fame, like, I'm not somebody who likes to live luxuriously. In fact, I feel guilty about it, because I just feel like there's so many other people who can't have this experience. Or I think like, oh, I'm going to ruin it. I'm going to make this dirty. Or I'm going to, you know, like, I like living like in apartments with like a, you know, Toyota Corolla or something. That's like my kind of life. So yeah. I'm a very pragmatic person. I'm not a very luxurious person. So that part of it never appealed to me. And I do think there is still also a lot of fear on my part, where I'm like, being, you know, Jennifer Lawrence or somebody like that would be, you know, she's a wonderful actress, but that would be too vulnerable for me. So I don't know if I'll ever do that, but I do think that I like doing stuff where I can be a part of something. So a couple, like if you had asked me 10 years ago, I would have said, no, I'm never going to be in film again. I'm never going to act again. But now I'm like, no, I probably would if it were fun, or if it were a passion project, you know? I think that would, you know, or if it was something that I was working on with friends, but I'm never going to be the type of person who seeks fame, I don't think. And I don't think I will ever be A-list ever again, because that's just too much pressure. The most important thing to me is finding something to be a part of.
Yeah. I'm so glad you've been a part of this with us today.
Nice way to tie it together.
Yeah, exactly. And so we like to sort of ask, you know, every guest a couple of the same questions. And AJ, you want to take it away here?
Yeah, the first one, Mara, is if you had children or your future child came to you and said, Mom, I would really like to be an actor, I would like to go ahead and start this thing, what would your answer be?
I would say probably not. I would probably not say yes to them if they were a child. I would probably say, why don't you work on, you know, theater or music or other performing arts that aren't as high risk? I would probably encourage that. I think the only way in which I would allow my child to act is if it were a very small project, or it were very definitely a one-time thing. They're in this one movie, they're in this one show. They get money that they can use later on for, you know, for college or to support them in their, you know, young adult life. And that's it. And that's, I think, a lot of the best child actor performances that I've seen in movies have been somebody who was in, you know, one movie or show. And they got money from that. They used it to go to college, or used it to, you know, support their new business when they're, you know, 25 or whatever. And they stop it at that. And I think that's really the only way, because I think otherwise it's just too out of control. I don't have kids. I would like to, but I do think that that's something that's very, that would probably, I would probably encourage them not to. I think there's just too many risk factors.
Yeah, I like that. Our last question to guests has something to do with that little bit of money that you tuck away to perhaps start a business at 25 or use in your young adult life. The question we like to ask everybody is, when you turn 18, you get your Coogan account money. What'd you do with it?
Well, I actually used it first to go to arts boarding school. I paid my own way through arts boarding school. And then I used it to go to college. And I used it at NYU. But I think that, like, I was still trying to be very sensible about it. Probably the thing that I did the most in New York, I spent my money on the most, were cabs. I used a lot of cabs. Yeah, a lot of cabs. And I think, like, I've realized recently, I was like, I don't do a lot of things for myself. So probably, like, the only thing that I did where I, like, used my money for, like, a big thing was I went to Iceland a couple years ago by myself. And that was really fun, because I realized, I was like, I've traveled to a lot of cool places, but it was always for work. And why don't I just go somewhere that I've never been, that I would like to be, and see some cool stuff and use my money to do that. And I did that. And that was, and I mean, it took me till, you know, 30 to do that. But, but that was something that I did. So I used it for boarding school and for college, and then to help support myself when I was, you know, doing like storytelling shows for like $50, you know, in New York. But yeah, I think that was probably the only like big luxurious thing I did, was like, I'm going to go to Iceland. And I had a great time there.
Awesome. That's so nice. And that's so much better than like buying 22-inch rims for your shitty vehicle. So, well done.
Yeah, exactly.
Mara, thank you for being so gracious with your time. Thank you for coming on here and sharing so much with us.
Yes. Yeah,
and Mara, again, you are, I don't know if you know, you've not only been such a wonder to talk to and reconnect with, but I'm really in such deep admiration for you as a person.
Thank you.
We both are. And we really think that your story is so wild and amazing and colorful and vibrant. And you're very much that type of person. And,
thank you.
You know, your clarity really frames our conversations for us moving forward with a lot of other former kid actors. And, you know, and I feel like you've chosen the path each time in your life, you know, of sometimes rough resistance, and you grow beautifully. And
thank
so
you.
It's so nice. Yeah. And it's so nice. I feel like for me, I sit there thinking, well, I'm going to have to measure up against Mara for the rest of my life. You know, but now that she's blazed.
Yeah.
The path,
you've set the bar for sure.
You've set the bar up high and, you know, and it's really beautiful.
Well, thank you. I'm overwhelmed that I can be that for other people, but that's, you know, that's really the best thing to be. So
you have. And again, thank you so much.
Thank you really so much.
Your time, Mara. Absolutely. All right, everybody. That concludes our chat with the absolutely wonderful Mara Wilson. We really hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. We were so happy and proud to share this with you guys. It's going to be so hard to top the wonderful, beautiful deep dive that we did with her. And she did it all with such charm, didn't she? Anyway, rate, review us, subscribe. Share it with a friend. Thanks so much. Join us next week where we, what are we going to do next week, AJ?
You know, the same thing we do every week, Chris, interview another former, to former kid actors about what it was like growing up in the biz.
Inky in the brain, anybody? Growing up in the biz. See you guys.